Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Colette Bennett. For years, Social Justice Ireland has been asking government to reduce the tax reliefs for private pension savings and use the money saved to help make the state pension universal, while maintaining it at a level that will ensure that Ireland's older people can achieve a decent standard of living. Despite the huge cost of these tax reliefs, which are intended to incentivise private pension savings, and the fact that the vast majority of this money goes to the better off, the trend in policy over that time has actually been towards greater emphasis on the private pension industry. What's influencing these policy decisions? Why are we moving towards a system of automatic enrolment into pension schemes for Irish workers, with the additional hundreds of millions of euros this will cost the taxpayer, while the government's support for the pensions industry via the tax relief system is never up for discussion? In this podcast, which is episode 3 in our interview series, my colleague Eamon Murphy sits down with Dr. Michelle Maher of Maynooth University to discuss the politics of pensions and how it has been possible for a group of people with a particular combination of expertise and access to help shape Ireland's pension system. The subjects discussed in this interview also have implications for other policy areas, not just pensions, and raise questions for the broader policy-making process. Enjoy.
So I'm here with Dr. Michelle Maher of Maynooth University. Michelle has worked for the last 3 years as a lecturer here in the Department of Sociology at Maynooth, and she's just about to leave it for an exciting new role, something that we're going to come to shortly. But first we're going to have a chat about something that I think is quite topical at the moment, and that's the subject of pensions. So first of all, you're very welcome, Michelle.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great stuff. How are you feeling this morning?
Very, very good. Thank you.
It's probably a lot to expect somebody who... put in their PhD thesis almost 3 years ago?
Three years plus.
To then to be able to revive a lot of that information. But we're going to talk about a topic that's you devoted actually 340 pages of a PhD thesis to a few years ago, which I think is very relevant to the current policy making context, which is the politics surrounding pensions. Not a subject that many people would sort of associate with politics a lot of the time, but I think personally, there's some very interesting political machinations going on behind the scene when it comes to policy making in pensions. And as I said, you've devoted more than 300 pages of a PhD thesis to it. You're probably the expert on the area in Ireland.
And that's very gracious of you.
I think last week the Central Statistics Office, they put out their results for their annual survey on pension coverage in Ireland. And you know, the results were pretty much in line with what's been out in previous years. You had about 60% of Irish workers are covered by private pension arrangements. That's up a tiny bit from last year. You know, you had various comments from the various mouthpieces of the pensions industry lamenting the relatively low pension coverage in Ireland, and all of the comments seem to be sort of contextualised in this idea that wouldn't things be so much better if pension coverage in Ireland was higher than it is now. You and I could sit here and talk for probably hours about pension coverage, pension related tax relief, state pension and all that, but we're going to focus today on, I suppose, on the pensions industry and the politics around it. And I suppose your thesis went into quite a lot of detail about where the power lies within the policy making context in pensions.
Yeah, so did.
Maybe she could start us off and tell us why pensions?
Why pensions? Well, I suppose I was interested, first of all, in policy making. How do some ideas get translated into like really solid policy decisions and other ideas are left by the wayside? And also, who owns those ideas that gets translated into policy? Because it occurred to me that if you're a policy actor and it's your ideas that get turned into policy, you know, that makes you quite powerful. And then I was also interested in pensions and the pension system in an earlier career. I worked in the pensions industry, but I had never really thought while I was working in pensions why our pension system looks the way it does. So the research idea I had was to try and pull those two things together. So it was to understand how policy is made in such a way that we have a system that looks the way it does. And I started back, I suppose, I approached it as, I also have a huge interest in history, so I actually took a historical perspective, and I'm kind of always drawn to that analogy that it's you know, it's the difference between looking at a photograph that's taken now and a film of which that photograph is the last still on the reel, you get much, much more information about why something looks the way it does when you take that historical perspective.
It's a really good analogy, actually.
So, any students that might be listening to this would be saying, Jesus, is she still talking about that? I need to, I suppose, credit, I think Paul Pearson is the person who originally came up with that idea to explain why taking a historical perspective is necessary to understand something. So for my research, I would have spent a huge amount of time in the National Archives, looking at the Department of Social Welfare, as it was then, their records of meetings about pensions from the 1960s onwards. I can actually tie, I suppose, the politics of pensions down to an exact date. It was June the 6th in 1973, to be precise. The two most senior civil servants in the Department of Social Welfare at the time held a meeting with this newly formed organisation, which was called the Irish Association of Pension Funds. And the IAPF had come to the department to tell them about themselves. And they presented their credentials as experts on private pensions, and they wanted to place that expertise at the department's disposal. And the second, I suppose, ambition they had for that meeting was to be consulted on any planned developments around the state pension. And I suppose what I would have found from that initial meeting, a relationship blossomed, which encompassed a really deep and intimate connection between knowledge about pensions and the power that brought.
I mean, how much of that was down to the fact that maybe these senior civil servants in the Department of Social Welfare, as it was at the time, their expertise maybe lay in other policy areas, maybe in unemployment benefits or whatever, mm-hmm. and they didn't feel that they had sufficient expertise in yep. pensions in order to bring in the necessary legislation that would regulate the industry, or maybe that would push policy in a certain direction, and therefore they ended up relying on this group.
Yep, that was part of the reason. I suppose it's a more complex and more gradual process than simply we don't have the expertise, so we're bringing it in, although that was a large part of it. I suppose, but just to backtrack to power, you know, if you're thinking about power, and power is multi-dimensional, I mean, I could outrank you, so even that if you disagree with me, what I want to happen happens. Or if I'm trying to avoid conflict between us, I could control the decision-making agenda, so what you want to discuss doesn't even make it onto the agenda. But I was interested in a dimension of power that engages, I suppose, with those kind of contemporary Marxist conceptions of ideational domination, hegemony. And that dimension of power is very hidden and possibly the least visible form of power. And it doesn't require any active intervention, because what it is, it involves being able to shape how decision makers perceive a policy problem, how they interpret things, and shape their preferences for the policy solution. Mm. So if you're in a position to do that in any policy field, I'm sure it's not just unique to pensions, it puts you in a very powerful position to influence the trajectory that policy making takes. So how do you do that? How could you have that kind of power? Well, as you identified, it is around knowledge and who has it and who doesn't. And that answer is captured in a concept which is called an epistemic community. Now, what's an epistemic community?
Exactly my next question.
Preempting you there, Eamon. Well, it's a network of professionals, and they have to have two things to be considered to be an epistemic community. One is that they have to have socially recognised expertise and competence. So it's not just, I'm an expert at this. That expertise has to be socially recognised. They also have to have this authoritative claim to policy relevant knowledge. And people who study these communities of experts will always consider them to be very powerful influencers of policy. So what I did was I had this kind of idea around, I want to understand how the pension system looks the way it does. I kind of understand that knowledge might be in here somewhere linked into power. So is there an epistemic community, and could I kind of find that community and then see what they did, and would that explain things for me? So I went off searching, as in the National Archives and the National Library, And as luck would have it, the Department of Social Welfare had been drawing up plans for an earnings-related addition to the state pension scheme. So
when was that? Was that still in the 70s or was it a bit later?
That was in the 70s, back in the 70s. There was this flat rate pension. Social insurance had come in 1960, but it was still a flat rate pension that was kind of pitched to alleviate poverty. But anything over and above that, you had to save with financial institutions, either through some kind of personal arrangement or through if your employer had an occupational pension scheme. So there was quite a lot of material over and back between the Department of Social Welfare, the Department of Finance and the Taoiseach's office. So, you know, there was a lot of documentation there to go through. And more recent documents were available online. And I also peppered various departments with Freedom of Information requests. So, you know, I built up quite a picture of a lot of correspondence from sort of the 1960s onwards. And I started to map out a network, and I have to say I will be eternally grateful to whoever kept the minutes for the Department of Social Welfare, because they were meticulous. They were really, really good meeting minutes. And not only did they do really good minutes of meetings, when a meeting was over, the civil servants would discuss their observations, and they also kept meticulous notes of those. So you actually got the minutes of the meeting, and then you got the observations of the civil servants afterwards.
That was quite the fine, wasn't it?
I was delighted. These records detailed the individuals that the department considered to be the experts. So what I did was I started to keep a log of the names that were appearing with much greater frequency than others, because they didn't just consult experts, or they didn't just consult the pensions industry, they were talking to employers, farmers' representatives.
So it wasn't just the industry or
no, it wasn't
the
just,
IAPF,
you know, and you know, they had an employer representatives, and you know, so they had quite a wide range of people that they were talking to, but they kept coming back to a number of individuals. And
was there any indication as to whether the industry representatives were there in their capacity as, say, members of the IAPF, or were they representing various financial consultancies or pensions firms? Which I probably shouldn't name names, but you know, any of the big few consultancy firms, were they?
They were there representing the Irish Association of Pension Funds. Now, interestingly, I suppose, who do the Irish Association of Pension Funds represent? Well, they would say that they represent pension funds, and I suppose by default the pension fund members, and maybe in the last decade they've kind of put more of an emphasis that they're representing pension savers, but I suppose the individuals who would have been there representing the Irish Association of Pension Funds would have been employed by commercial pension companies. So you know, as I said, I started to keep a log of the names that were appearing with greater frequency. And then a National Pensions Board was set up in the 1980s to produce a number of reports on pensions. So I was kind of looking to see, well, who was appointed to that? And then following on for that, we had the Statutory Pensions Board. Who was on that? Well, there was a National Pensions Policy Initiative in the 1990s with various committees. Who was sitting on that? And when I finished kind of mapping out all of these people, I was left with about a dozen names. But they, you know, they could have been just, you know, 11, as it was 11 unconnected individuals. So I had to then see, did they form a network? Well, yes, they did, as it so happened, because all bar one of them worked in one of just two pensions industry related firms. The majority of them at some stage or another held a position as head of a professional organisation and or a representative organisation. And the majority were from the actuarial profession. Interestingly, only two of them were women, and if we have time, I could talk at length about the gendered findings that I had. So when you read about epistemic communities, what jumps out at you is this idea of professionalism and how professionalism underpins their cohesiveness, because, of course, a network has to be cohesive, and it reinforces a very strong common culture. And because the majority of them were from the actuarial profession, you know, there's very rigorous entry requirements to that, indicating high status and expertise in a pensions related field. So they very much, these names, this network that I had identified, satisfied all the criteria that anyone who studies these communities of experts requires to be present. So I very much said, well, I had now an epistemic community that was operating within the policy field of pensions.
And one certainly that would have very vested interests in where they want to see pension policy going as well, particularly if they're working or formerly working for pensions consultancies, if they're actuaries, then, you know, they tend to have a particular view of how, how the industry should be framed.
I mean, the pension system that we have, with its continuous emphasis on strengthening the private component of the system, certainly is of commercial value to the industry. But they were also people who understood pensions, and they may not have consciously been trying to deliberately, I don't think they deliberately set out
to direct policy in a way that's favourable to their...
Yeah, I can't say that was their...
Yeah. It's more that, their advice is influenced by a particular view of the industry,
yeah.
Maybe. And that's...
Yeah.
I mean, I know myself as somebody who, like yourself, worked in the pensions industry in a previous life. And
you'd
having
never question it. Yeah.
No, you chat, even now I chat to some of my former colleagues, and they don't understand why the organisation that I work for now is against the very generous tax relief for pensions, mm-hmm. or they don't question the fact that the government subsidises the industry to the extent mm-hmm. of maybe somewhere between 2 and 3 billion euros every year. This is just
yeah.
how it's done, and you need
yeah.
that tax relief to encourage people to save.
Yeah.
It couldn't be any other way in their eyes, you know.
I interviewed 8 of the epistemic community members that I had identified, and you know, they all had this common policy enterprise. They like truly believed that the best pension system for the country was one where the government allocated whatever resources it had to a poverty alleviating flat rate pension, and that the heavy lifting, if you like, anything over and above that, could be done by the industry, who had been doing it all along mm-hmm. and were, in their opinion, good at it, and it worked, and all they needed to do was to find some way of improving coverage to get more people into the private element. So, which of course would be of commercial value to them. So, how did they gain power? You know, I suppose was the next question that I had. I had this community, you know, but how did they gain power? And I suppose this goes back to what we were talking about at the moment, was the knowledge. So to set the scene, the Department of Social Welfare were ploughing ahead with this idea that the state pension would become earnings related. They were afraid that the existing system as it was in the 1970s was going to create what they refer to as a pensions elite. And the pensions elite, as far as they could, as they understood it, were people who worked for employers that gave them an occupational pension.
Okay.
And they were the pensions elite. And if you worked for an employer who didn't provide an occupational pension, you were going to be left behind in the pension system. And they very much wanted to avoid that. And the firm belief at the time, driven by the likes of Brendan Corish, who were in government at the time, so they wanted to try and do something within the state pension that would also give an earnings related aspect to the pensions that people would get. And in that way, if their employer didn't provide an occupational pension, they weren't being left behind. So this, of course, would have been at odds with, I suppose, a pensions industry perspective, who would have much preferred those employers who weren't providing pensions for their employees to start doing it with them,
yeah.
rather than leaving it to the state. So that was the just to set the scene. So anything that other than the state providing this flat rate subsistence level of pension was going to be potentially quite detrimental to the pensions industry. So I would have identified, I suppose, 4 or 5 aspects of how they gained power. First of all was the demand for information, especially in government and civil servant circles. You know, senior civil servants who were working there in the 1970s and 80s would have told me, you know, these people from the industry were crucial to us because they had the expertise. They even talked about how they thought about trying to recruit one or two of them, but they realised very quickly that they wouldn't have been able to match the salaries that the pensions industry were paying. The epistemic community members that I interviewed themselves spoke at length about having to do an awful lot of explaining to the civil servants. And I think something that probably still happens in the in civil service circles, although I'm not an expert, is that, you know, the epistemic community members all along would say we would have somebody and we would have brought them up to speed on pensions, and then they would move off into another department and we'd have to start again. And I think just the nature
you see that
of,
even now, I think.
The nature of promotion within the civil service, I think they value generalists rather than specialists. I'm not an expert, that's just my observation. But that certainly helped, because the epistemic community were constant, but the civil servants were changing, so there was always this demand for information. There was also kind of an uncertainty around data, because unbelievably, the Department of Social Welfare had no way of knowing who was in an occupational pension and who wasn't. So a minister who would have been involved around that decade told me he described it as being beholden to the industry because they had valuable material that was unavailable to the government. Now, I didn't see any evidence that the industry tried to leverage that holding of information into power, but the civil servants and the minister were acutely aware of it. And to gain power, I suppose I watched or read in everything I was finding how this narrative was created by the epistemic community members, and they described over and over again the pension system being a partnership, and it was a partnership between the state and the pensions industry, and both of these partners had very distinct roles within the partnership. The government was to provide this flat rate pension that would keep people out of poverty, and the industry would do the rest. And that idea of a pension system as a partnership gained traction in policy making circles. And it was a very successful narrative at undermining the idea of a stronger role for the state in the system. They were helped, of course, this narrative was helped by, I suppose, the dire financial circumstances. I don't know if anyone listening to this was around in 1980 or 1981, but there was dire financial circumstances is what I call it. And that, of course, created political tension between the Department of Social Welfare, who wanted this addition to the pension system, and the Department of Finance, who were dealing with a very precarious public purse. So the epistemic community started to point out that there were these like considerable demands on the country's limited resources for housing, for education, for health, probably not unlike a narrative that we might hear now. You know, there was high unemployment, so, you know, funds should be going into the creation of jobs, and the government shouldn't be directing its really, you know, sparse resources to a pension system when they could be putting it into all these other areas and just let the industry get on with what it did best.
Right, we could be talking about 2020 rather than 1981.
We certainly could. And then I suppose the final thing that happened was a number of very high profile companies went bust. Ferenca over in Limerick comes to mind. H. Williams, I think, was another one, and left their pension systems in deficit, sometimes with unpaid employer contributions. And this drew attention to the lack of regulation around occupational pensions. So attention turned away from the pension system reform and this stronger role for the state pension, and turned to creating a regulatory environment. And once that was put in place and attention turned back to what sort of a pension system do we want, this idea of a pensions elite that had so worried policymakers back in the 70s had disappeared, and this idea of the pension system as a partnership between the state and the industry was locked into place.
So you've described there how this epistemic community gained power, but that was the 70s, that was the 80s, that was, there's a lot of turnover sometimes in these government departments. I mean, how was it that this same community managed to push on with that power into the 1990s, into the 2000s, despite changes of government, changes of ministers, changes of senior civil servants? How did this reliance on that group maintain itself?
Okay. How it maintained itself was helped by their involvement in creating this, you know, badly needed regulatory environment. And I'm talking about the 1990 Pensions Act, because what I was surprised to learn was that it was individuals from the pensions industry that drafted the 1990 Pensions Act. And I suppose, you know, if you sit back and think about that for a moment, it really is remarkable that the cornerstone of regulatory legislation in Ireland was written by the industry being regulated. So that kind of jumped out at me for a number
of... you'd imagine, you can't imagine the construction industry or the architects federation or whatever they are being given rights over regulating.
Well, wouldn't it be interesting to find out?
Maybe I'm being too naive. Sorry, go on.
The civil servants and the ministers that I spoke to explained why, and really it was a fear that if the civil servants tried to draft regulations for the pensions industry, that the industry would poke holes in it and that they would be a laughing stock. So actually getting the experts to write it meant that it went through Badal unchallenged, because everybody knew that the top experts in the country had gone through it with a fine-tooth comb. And I mean, this meets any definition you like of regulatory capture, but that wasn't my focus, because what that led me towards was trying to understand how the 1990 Pensions Act allowed advice to be captured, because I was still honing in on, you know, this knowledge and this ability to influence policy. What the 1990 Pensions Act, which we know were written by members of the epistemic community, was that it stipulated that a statutory pension board should be established. And it would be populated by those with a major interest in pension schemes. So there was like one representative each from trade unions and employers and social welfare and finance, and the rest of the places were largely industry related. So civil servants would say to me, like, we kind of sleepwalked into it. We gave them responsibility for the pensions board. And why I'm kind of labouring this point is that the pensions board had a very important function on top of regulation, because they were also responsible for pensions advice straight into the minister. And I suppose this is where my definition of power comes into play. You know, they were now very well placed to shape how problems around pensions are understood and what the policy solutions for them should be.
And as you kind of alluded to earlier as well, Dave, they're in a position now to decide what it is that needs deciding.
Yeah.
And to influence which options are on the table for that.
Now, people who sat on the pensions board, and I interviewed quite a lot of them, told me that, you know, this, people kept talking about hats, you know, that hats were left at the door, and that they weren't in there to protect the industry. But a senior civil servant remembers it slightly differently, saying, yeah, they'd all leave their hats at the door for a little while and then they'd run around and put them back on again. You know, they were good people. The quote is, you know, they were good people on top of their game, but they wore hats. So throughout the 1990s and into the 2000s, I traced how this very firm policy enterprise, first articulated, I was back in the 1970s, of the pension system as a partnership with the industry doing all the heavy lifting, and then the state sticking to a flat rate pension, got, I suppose, so firmly entrenched that policymakers, to me, seemed only capable of thinking within those confines. And that's what I mean about power being exercised, so that preferences and perceptions are shaped, so that anything else is just unthinkable and wrong. Part and parcel of this, of course, and it bubbles up in stories around pensions from time to time, is the tax relief that is given to people who save privately for pensions. And I suppose that is the unique selling point for pension products, that you get tax relief at the marginal rate of tax that you are that you pay your income tax at. And that's quite a sizable amount, running at anywhere between 2 and 3 billion.
Yeah, when you factor in not just the relief on that, but also the tax-free lump sum that people can get at retirement, the tax-free investment returns, you're talking, as you say, somewhere between 2 and 3 billion euros a year being foregone by government.
And if you were looking, and you know, I suppose I think that expenditure once upon a time was justified. It was justified when perhaps occupational pensions provided a defined benefit pension scheme. So they were fulfilling that kind of earnings related function that back in the 70s the state was so keen to see happening. But that's not the case now, where the vast majority of people in the private sector are in defined contribution pensions that bear no resemblance to their income at retirement.
That's been a real transfer of the risk from employers and the industry to onto the individual.
Yeah. Which is part of this policy trajectory that we're on, and which gets cemented into place with the automatic enrolment addition. And I might come to that later on, but I just want to kind of stick with the tax relief at the moment, because, okay, nowhere along the line, they didn't really start to try and quantify it until there was a green paper in 2008, and that was when they first tried to quantify the amount of this tax expenditure, because we had in the 1990s, we had sort of, I suppose, our first national conversation, as I call it, about pensions in the National Pension Policy Initiative. And I won't bore you with the details, but it was very clear when you read all of the documentation how tax relief was taken off the agenda in quite a strange way in that National Pension Policy Initiative.
So it was never up for discussion, really, whether this would be taken away.
No, it was sort of said that, look, this has been examined earlier, but when you went back to look at the earlier reports, it hadn't really examined it in the way of quantifying it and to see, does it do the job it's supposed to do? Because the idea of the tax expenditure within the pension system is to incentivize people. And as the very beginning you spoke about coverage, it wasn't working at getting people to start saving for pensions. And then you look to see who was getting it. And there's been a lot of work done around that. And it isn't spread very equitably. It's concentrated in the top decile of the earnings distribution. And there's also a gender aspect to that, because the top decile of the earnings distribution is not where you find women in very large numbers.
Yeah.
People who are outside of the tax net altogether don't get any of this huge amount of money that goes to supporting.
I think the findings by Micheál Collins and Jerry Hughes is that about 72% of that money is going to people in the top 20% of earnings. So it's, as you say, it's very inequitable. And I suppose I remember reading that that green paper from 2008 as part of research I was doing. It's quite a while ago now. And what I recall is that they discussed the idea of, say, universalising the state pension. And then they disregarded it because they felt it would be too costly, that it would increase expenditure. They estimated by approximately 1.2 billion in a year, I think, at the time. So to hear then that this very costly system of tax relief that costs more than double that, and I think actually cost about triple that at the time, that wasn't even up for discussion, that they felt that they'd dealt with the issue and moved on. It's extraordinary to think of the kind of influence that can lead governments to think that way, well, we can't possibly consider this extra billion, but we're also not going to consider saving three times that by possibly changing the structure of relief.
Yeah. Now, the Troika, when we had the Great Recession in 2008, the Troika started to get interested in this tax expenditure and had put forward, I suppose, a prompt that the government should look at standardising it, just giving tax relief at the 20% rate. I mean, and that's happened for things like private health insurance and mortgage interest relief. On top of that, there was a tax commission in 2009 who had kind of also started to highlight the inequitable distribution, and it was recommending sort of maybe a standard 33%, somewhere in the middle, or some sort of matching contributions. It had some very innovative ideas around how that tax expenditure could be, rearranged in a way that had more equitable outcomes from the pension system. And I suppose that was the point in my study, just to go back to my epistemic community again, I promise the last time I'll mention them. I think that was where I saw them, the demise of them, because on that question of the tax relief, because whereas before it had been quite a cohesive group, they had a common policy enterprise, there seemed to be some people from the financial services industry who had spoken to the then minister, the guy from Limerick, Noonan, and persuaded him that instead of messing with the tax relief system for private pensions, that they would instead bring in a pension fund levy. And but that didn't seem to be a unanimous common policy enterprise from all of the industry, as had been the case, and they kind of splintered at that stage and no longer satisfied many of the criteria to be considered as an epistemic community. But I felt that that was kind of irrelevant because this idea that they had was so locked into place and still is, you know, that we're following this policy trajectory unwaveringly as a country, and that that's at the, and with the prospect of so many more people starting to save for pensions with commercial pension companies under automatic enrolment, I think that that is ultimately the culmination of a policy enterprise that was put into place on what date did I say it was in June? The 6th of June 1973, that we're actually still seeing that policy trajectory.
That's written all over the incoming automatic enrollment system, the idea that we have a certain amount of resources to devote to the system and here's how we're going to do it, rather than, say, bolstering the state pension, we're going to devote additional incentives to private savers.
I mean, I actually would have to applaud the automatic enrolment initiative in terms of, I think that for once there seemed to be a minister and policy making people within the Department of DEASP that, you know, wanted to have a go at it and to try and do something about it. And I would have seen the minister, you know, at various events around the country. So I felt that there was an energy and a really deep understanding, but not to the extent where they were going to revisit decisions that had been made decades before that were locked into place. Mm. And I mean, even in the responses to the, there was a green paper in 2008 to look at the future of the pension system in Ireland. And when they collated all of the responses of that, the minister at the time, I'm going to say Mary Hanafin, but I could be wrong, kind of highlighted how there was no consensus in the submissions about how things should look. So even though there's no, you know, so it, this policy trajectory isn't supported by any kind of consensus by people with an opinion on pensions, but yet it still seems to be what we're following. It's going to be supported by a central processing unit that, as far as I know, hasn't been costed at all. A new government body that is set up to receive contributions from employers and divvy them out to the correct financial institutions. So I don't think the costs of that are coming into play at all. And I haven't seen, maybe it's happened, but I'm not aware of it, you know, that those kind of costs and the costs of the extra tax relief or whatever the incentive will be to all of these new savers who are going to come in under automatic enrolment. And how does that compare to going back perhaps to some kind of semblance of that idea back in the 1970s of a stronger role for the state? I mean, we have a central collection point within the PRSI system that seems to work. We have a social insurance fund. You know, and I don't see that they have been costed as a viable alternative to what we're proposing here.
One final question on pensions, because I want to chat to you as well about an interesting new venture you're embarking upon. I suppose the key question from all of this, from your thesis, from what we've discussed, is less related to the pensions industry and more related to the implications for policy making overall, that if civil servants and government departments and politicians allow themselves to be the victims, we'll say, of what you described as capture. What was the exact term you used again?
Yeah, capture of the advice.
Yeah, that if they're receiving the key advice from certain groups who, yes, they have a vested interest, and we discussed how in many cases they're capable of leaving that hat at the door, but it does mean that they view the area that they're looking to regulate or to influence a certain way. and to the exclusion sometimes of alternative views. I mean, what's the overall implication for policymaking if this is how our system is working? I mean, are you aware maybe of other industries where...
I'm not, but if anyone wants to pay me to do another PhD, I'd be very, very happy. I think the implications are that to look at the idea, because every policy is based on an idea, and to see, you know, are we kind of locked into a way of thinking? We may not even be aware of that we have a preference, or trying to understand where that preference comes from. So I think having a diverse range of people in that policymakers will consult, that they're not just going to the same people who may tell them the same thing, but they're actually going to people who will challenge it and say, you know, where is that idea coming from? And why aren't you thinking about this, that, and the other? I think that that's the big implication that I would have found. That, you know, especially now there's such an opportunity to think innovatively about our system and to really shake those decades-old ideas and see, do they still have relevance? But I feel that opportunity has been missed.
That's great. Thanks very much for that, Michelle. That was really interesting stuff.
Thank you very much. I can't believe that somebody finds pensions interesting besides myself, but there you go.
So what I also want to talk to you about is, as I mentioned at the beginning of our chat, you're moving on from Maynooth University. In fact, you've already started a new role.
Yeah,
you're kind of combining the two of them at the moment.
Yeah.
Your new position is as Regional Development Officer for the SHE programme. That's S-H-E, stands for See Her Elected. And I believe there's an association there with Longford Women's Link as well.
Yeah, and also 50-50 Northwest.
And the idea is that the purpose of the programme is to support rural women in running for election. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I started work on just Monday, 3 days ago, with the SHE project. It's an innovative, I suppose, regional partnership. It's between Longford Women's Link and 50-50 Northwest. And 50-50 Northwest are based in Donegal, Sligo and Leitrim. And the overall aim of the SHE project, SHE for standing for See Her Elected, is to empower women in the Northwest and the Midlands to engage in electoral politics, to understand, you know, what politics is about. And the focus is on local government. It's been funded by the Department of Housing, Planning and Local Government, which is initially being rolled out in the Midlands and the Northwest. And why those counties? Well, when you look at the county councils, I mean, some of the city councils are beginning to see more women coming into local government. I think Dunleary Rathdown is almost 50-50, if not at 50-50. Compare that to Longford, where you have 39, I think, councillors, of which only one is a woman.
You're joking.
No.
One out of 39.
Leitrim has three, the 32 on Leitrim County Council, three of them are women. Donegal have 37 county councillors, only four of them. Sligo has 35 county councillors.
Those are pretty shocking numbers. When you talk about, we talk about how we're pretty poor in the Dáil, which maybe is a 22 or 23% are women.
Mm. Actually, I'm just going to correct myself there, because the figures I was giving about one out of 39 in Longford, it was 39 candidates who ran. Only one of those candidates who were elected were a woman, and there's actually 18, so it's one out of 18 councillors in Longford.
Still,
I beg your pardon.
Pretty paltry return.
It is four out of 37 county councillors in Donegal. Roscommon, there's 18 county councillors with only three women, and it's 18 again in Sligo with only three of them women. So, you know, I suppose the overall picture in local authorities may be a bit brighter. But when you start to look at those rural, so this is very much a rural initiative, those rural counties, the picture is very, very stark. And I think I should say I would be as equally exercised by this if there was one man on Longford County Council.
I'm glad to hear that.
Because, I mean, I would think about, you know, like, you know, about all these wonderful, innovative men, and where are their ideas, and, you know, all the decision making that happens in county councils. And you couldn't possibly do that with just one man bringing in his his perspective on things into the council chamber. So why on earth do we think we can do it with just one woman or three women or four women if you're talking about Donegal? So there's a particular, I suppose, set of difficulties that are involved when it comes to running for election or even thinking about running for election in rural Ireland that are perhaps slightly more manageable in a more urban setting. So that's the focus of this project. And I suppose our focus would very much be on the local elections, which are next scheduled for 2024. So we'll see how we go by then. Because of course, gender quotas, which we have in place at the national government level, don't come into play at local government. They haven't carried down that quota.
Yeah, of course, local government is a very important feeder into the national level.
Yeah, very much so. It's a very, you know, if you look at, you know, the women who are in the Dáil, where did they come from? You see how important is a pipeline into national politics local government is.
It's an interesting line to draw because, as you know, the quota system at national level means that parties miss out on a certain element of national funding if less than one third of their national level candidates are women, or one third of each, men and women.
Yeah.
So I suppose the idea there isn't necessarily that we have to elect equal numbers, but that there has to be more equality in putting people forward, which of course causes parties to go looking for talent. But where are they going to find that talent if they don't have elected representatives at a local government level?
So it's very much in the interests of the political parties, but also I refer to them as the gatekeepers, the people who are running the selection campaigns or the selection committees that happen right down in each local electoral division in each county. You know, it's in everyone's best interest to try and engage with a project like SHE, because you get better politics, you get a more rounded sense of what's happening in the communities that you're trying to represent if you're engaging with both men and women and bringing them into the council chamber. And you also then are building up this talent bank of men and women who are there available to go forward so that you meet the gender quota for either males or females going into national politics. So, you know, I think it's a win for everybody.
You're talking about pretty large parts of the country being deprived of that female perspective and all the different ways that running a particular local authority area could be influenced by that voice. And it's very hard to expect, it's impossible really to expect one person in a room full of 18 to...
And I do think where there's that one councillor in Longford with out of 18, or the three women in Roscommon, or the four in Donegal, you know, there's probably a tendency as well to default that they will be the people who will speak on what are women's issues, you know, like childcare or playgrounds, as if men don't also have children who play in playgrounds. So I think, you know, part of this project is political education. And, you know, I think it would be better politics for everyone, because women don't just have opinions on things that are deemed to be women's issues. They have opinions on policies that affect everybody, men and women alike.
Pensions included.
We hope you've enjoyed our podcast. Remember, if you go to www.socialjustice.ie, you can download our fully costed proposal for a universal state social welfare pension, or check out our articles and presentations on this and other policy topics. Until next time, thank you for listening.